I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
All right, this is our fullest house yet. I'm Patrick Martins. You're listening to the Main Course OG. We are broadcasting live out of Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn. This is very, very fun show today. We're really packed in here. There's so many living beings in here. It's like that phenomenon where like we cease being clean and taking care of our young and stuff. It's like so many people. So let me get right into it. We have Ann Saxelby, the lovely Ann Saxelby. We have Emily Pearson,
host. Good morning.
We have James Wetlore from England.
Yes, hello.
We have host Brandon Hoy, owner of Roberta's.
Ah.
And then we're very happy to have some special guests from a local community just north of New York. We have Dan Purdy.
Beautiful day, thank you.
Dan's a processor of meats along with his wife Vicky.
Hello.
And hello, Anna. We also have Hannah, who's a great PR lady, and for Big Green Egg, for Goat-tober, which is a big thing. So let me throw it to Emily so we can jump right in.
He's already taken up too much of my part this morning. Sorry. Come on. All right. So this episode is very much about Goat-tober. We've been talking about it all month. But in the room, we really have the founding energies of Goat-tober. As Patrick mentioned, we have Ann Saxelby. We have James Wetlore. And he didn't really mention himself and Heritage Foods. So these are sort of the where it all began.
I'm very humble.
Yes. Are you done with your British accent
yes.
for the morning? Okay. Anyway, Goat-tober is a project that was designed to find a use for male dairy goats, which had forever been a huge example of food waste. And the answer we quickly learned was, of course, to eat them. So we're going to sort of dive right in. That's going to be a topic a little bit today, food waste, among other newsworthy items. So I don't know if you guys heard. This week, the livelihood of almost 200 Brooklyn businesses was jeopardized by the abrupt and recent closure of Pilot Works, one of the main commercial kitchens here in Brooklyn. The closure has affected both the kitchen and the distribution arm and left nearly, as we said, 200 businesses without a production facility or a means to distribute their products to clients across the New York area. This is a setback that can put many of these producers out of business and is really a blow to the independent food ecosystem as a whole. Not to mention, there's some major high-profile investors in this project, the founders of Sweetgreen and Blue Hill co-owner David Barber. And as recently as December, they had received $13 million in VC funding. So what happened? What do you guys think?
This is an odd one, too, because they also closed down two other locations. Like, right? Last month, they closed down Portland, Maine, and I think they closed down one in Rhode Island. So my first thought was that they were having problems with possibly the landlord, right? This is a big building, the Pfizer building. There's lots of tenants in there. It could be kind of a shit show in that building itself. Mm-hmm. So initially I'd saw that, but then once I realized that they had closed other locations, it just kind of seemed like maybe they couldn't figure it out, right? And at a certain point, you're just like, oh shit, this thing's just sucking money, and we got to end this now. But didn't they just raise $13 million?
$13 million.
They said, you know, I was reading a little bit about it because I didn't know all the backstory. And one of the comments was that they put a lot of that money into expansion rather than trying to kind of, you know, foster and grow their existing locations. So I think that can be kind of a classic setback in the food business, whether you're running a restaurant or anything else. If you, you know, are expanding without kind of, you know, growing what you already have in place, you can set yourself up for disaster.
Yeah, your CapEx, like the heart of what you do, the investment back into that usually is your best investment, right? If you haven't taken care of business at home, yet you're still trying to like go out and expand, that's usually where small businesses, well, I guess large businesses in this case, could, you know,
but what about their social responsibility? I mean, apparently they gave 2 hours notice and like faked it by back timing the email. No, like someone said that they found out that they had 2 hours to get their stuff out, but they got the email 2 hours late. We should also mention, you know, Hot Bread Kitchen, which is also its own food incubator of sorts, is really trying to help businesses that have lost their space with Pilot Works. And they've set up a hotline and you can call and they're a resource. They're trying to pair people with new kitchens and new spaces. But social responsibility, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I have a quote from in a great book called The Carnivore's Manifesto. It's Bob Dylan wrote it.
Written by Patrick.
To live outside the law, you must be honest. Bob Dylan wrote that. And also, for our movement to move forward and to progress, we have to hold ourselves up to standards that are cosmically ahead of the capitalist curve. And I'll just say real quick, what bothers me about this is that big names lent themselves to these small purveyors investing and putting all their destiny into this. Big names, the Barber name, the Sweetgreen name. That should count for something because, you know, we got screwed out of a lot of money by a guy who then went open the restaurant upstate. And the reason we lost his money is because his name was still associated with the restaurant group that wasn't paying us. And when you leave your name to garbage like this and when you screw that many people, it's upsetting. I think Barber and these people need to find a way to fix it. It shouldn't cost that much for them themselves out of their own pocket because they use their name to make profits, to find a way to get some kitchen space. Help these people out. They should be working 30-hour days to try to fix this mess. And they can't say, oh, it wasn't my fault. I was just an investor. Bullshit. You have fiduciary responsibility.
But won't those tenants have legally binding contracts where they have some, I mean, will it end up in loads of litigation?
Well, I think probably they have great contracts that exempted any responsibility of the guys because they are lawyer types. And there's one thing that I dislike as much as Republican ideas. I love Republicans, Dan, but I do. There's one thing I don't like. It's the Wall Street guys. It's the Goldman Sachs guys, guys who deal with nothing other than money. They don't do anything real. And that kind of is that ethos that can say goodbye to 200 businesses.
Yeah, just the human consequences don't matter. The day-to-day people's lives don't matter. It's just the money.
Who's that great group in England, the Neil's Yard Dairy guys, who helped restart an entire neighborhood, right, for artisans? It would be as if they went under and all those artisans were like, those guys weren't paying the rent or something. What was that, under the train tracks?
Oh, Borough Market.
Borough Market, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's rippling effects to this as well, right? Not only is there the sadness of these people like losing their ability to provide, but there's also the people that are providing too. Like these were bakeries and cheesemongers, and these were people that were making things that were providing to small businesses that are coffee shops or retail bakeries that were also looking to receive product that they didn't get to receive because with no notice, these people were just pushed to the street.
And the farmers and all that were selling to them. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little shocking the way that it was done. It's like you hear of restaurants closing the same way where like people come into work one day and they're told this is your last day. You know, it's not happening anymore. And I think that, you know, it's not fair when that happens in any circumstance, but even more so with this, because like you said, 200 businesses, you have to have a transition plan in place for people.
I'll tell you, you don't just like wake up in the morning and you're like, I gotta close my restaurant.
Exactly.
Like there's plenty of lead time to this. The runway's long.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Jamie Oliver had something similar in the UK recently. Hmm. He was told that his Barbacoa restaurant was going under and he had to fork out $3 million of his own money. And then they went into a voluntary credit agreement, and then they slowly paid off all the suppliers and made sure everybody got paid. Mm-hmm. They wound it up properly. So it's not like it's impossible to do.
Yeah.
And I think this also goes to what Patrick was saying, you know, when we're also being told exactly who the deep pockets were, and these people have their neck on the line and their name and reputation on the line, you know, is there going to be a point where this story comes back around that they did the right thing, or they... Mm-hmm. They, you know, maybe Jamie Oliver put in his own money. I don't know how exactly it went, but
he's a good guy. He's known as a stand-up guy, that guy, Jamie Oliver. Let's go to the next story. But another thing is this Me Too movement. And when guys get kicked out of their restaurants, get out of your restaurant in 2 or 3 weeks. Get it all done. Sacrifice some money. But if you're going to scratch for every single penny, even though you're almost a billionaire, and keep your terrible name associated with the restaurant, that hurts all the dishwashers and the waiters and the chefs that are like, get that guy's name out of our restaurant. It's just money corrupts, and it's very sad. We have to hold ourselves cosmically above the capitalist curve if we're going to succeed as a slow food movement.
All right, we're totally changing the direction of this with this next story. The U.S. Cattlemen's Association petitioned the USDA to declare that the terms meat and beef exclude products not slaughtered in the traditional manner. So can non-meat substitutes be called meat, in your opinion? What do you also think about a few weeks ago we talked about barcodes that could be sprayed onto meat to be scanned for traceability and to determine fake versus real meat?
Dan, you're a processor. You kill animals. You cut them with your own hands. What do you think?
Okay, so you're saying what now? So, okay, let's talk about the spray on barcode, correct? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's an edible ink currently. And every when you have cattle or pork, there's a stamp on. They stamp the animal at least 3 places, right?
Right.
So you have to stamp it. With the inspection, plants inspection number stating it's USDA inspected. There's also grading stamps, correct? Now, I've never heard of the barcode.
So this is apparently a new thing. I think it's coming out of England first. It was definitely not the U.S. And the idea was that you could, with this edible ink, it would be invisible, though, supposedly, but you could scan it and it would allow not only the consumer, but the sort of trickle-down effect after it leaves the processor to know if someone said they were selling you a heritage breed, did they really sell you a heritage breed? Mm.
And I think there was some meat that was being sold as meat, but it wasn't really meat. Who knows what that was?
This is the problem. When people start selling trees as meat, there's a world out there where this is going to crumble on somebody. It's like, I don't want to eat wood. I like paid for beef. I want to know that it's beef and not wood.
Does it piss you off that they call things steak when it's made out of chickpeas?
First of all, you know my reaction to this. It's like one of my like. This thing kills me
that when they steal the names.
Yeah, it's like if you don't want to eat meat, that's fine. Eat vegetables. There's lots of great vegetables and things to eat out there. But don't like turn your like compost into a hamburger.
Yeah,
it's disgusting. It's also just not a hamburger.
Yeah.
To me, it's just the dumbing down of society. You know, look, meat is meat, right? Beef is beef. Pork is pork. Lamb is lamb. Yada yada. Vegetable protein is not meat.
Yeah, if you don't like meat, don't call it by the thing you don't like.
But going to
it's like everything becoming like, you know, like overly PC. It's really good to be like respectful of like everyone's different decisions that they make, whether it's like sexual orientation or diet or how they want to eat or whatever. But at a certain point, you just have to call a noun a noun. Yes,
but what about meat dairy?
There's a similar battle raging for milk, you know, because all of these new alternative milks, nut milk, soy milk,
they're
you know,
not milk.
Oatly, I like that one.
Not milk, you
no,
know?
No, they're not milk. I don't drink those.
It's very funny. And I guess, I think it was the head of the USDA made a comment where he said, you know, nuts don't lactate. And it set off this like firestorm of you know, all the nut milk people went crazy. And they were like, but how can you threaten our livelihood? And it's like, well, yeah, it's
and
nut
you know
milk.
This as a fact, some nuts lactate.
Yeah.
Some nuts lactate.
I'm one of them in a few weeks. No, I'm just kidding. But it's like at a certain point you just have to. It is what it is, and if it's an alternative, then you come up with another name for it.
The French have banned it.
Oh, really?
The French have gone out and said if it's not a meat product, you can't call a mushroom burger a hamburger. It has to be on the labeling. It has to say that it is. You can't name vegan bacon. Mm-hmm. It can't be called bacon. Mm-hmm. So they've got ahead of it, and I think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, that's because that's the fact.
Well, yeah. it's also I think the French look at it as like you're trying to trick the consumer.
Well, and the French are real pioneers in that because with cheese, you know, they started that a long time ago. They were the first people to put an AOC designation on certain cheeses and wines to ensure that the product you're buying is the product you're buying. If you're buying a bottle of Burgundy wine, it is actually that thing. And so they've always been very proactive when it comes to
the farmers have a lot of clout in France. Mm-hmm. It's a big part, still a big part of their society.
Definitely.
The French are so annoying. They're like, they're the only country in the world that didn't call a computer a computer. They're like, we will call it an ordinateur. You know, everyone else is just like, it's a computer.
The French farmers have got it right. I mean, I remember being on holiday in Rhodes a few years ago, and there was a campaign that the French were doing, and the farmers just backed a truck of rotting onions onto the steps of the state house and tipped it all over there. I don't know what they're protesting about.
Oh, they
but
do.
They just get out there and they're really proactive with their
what
the
about
dairy
Jose
farmers
Beauvais?
Do too. They go, they dump milk, you know, like truckloads of milk at the steps
calves,
of the Secretary of Agriculture, you know.
I've seen videos, they just let calves free in supermarkets if they drop the price of the milk.
Jose Beauvais rammed a McDonald's. He drove his truck to a McDonald's and Carlo Petrini called him to bra and hailed him as a hero. He's like, nice move, dude, you know. I'm like, this guy just drove a truck.
Direct action.
So I want to go back to the barcode thing, though. So in essence, they've been doing that from day one. They've been stamping, animals, from day one. So, I mean, to have a barcode in the same way, I mean, it's just technology using an old system.
But I guess that information has never been in the consumer's hands. We've always just been told what we're eating, but have never really had the ability to question it, you know, or to prove it. So is that something, I don't know, it may not take off. Maybe it's expensive.
Well, for traceability, too, it's probably a good idea. You know, you hear about all these companies investing, too, in, like, blockchain supply, where you can, like, trace the mango from the place it was grown to, like, the Walmart it ends up in. And, I read an interesting article that was like, you know, Walmart, they did a mock trial where they were trying to trace, you know, some sort of tainted fruit back to its source, and it took them 7 days, which, you know, is too long when people are getting sick. And it's like, if you're going to make the food chain, you know, then the food supply as intense as it is, then you also owe it to consumers to be able to, you know, get bad product off the shelf. And so, in my opinion, if a barcode or something like that helps them do that, then it's actually good for consumers.
So in our plant, we have recall mechanisms. We have to do it in 4. Why Walmart has 7 days to do it with no barcode? Yes. So I'll never know that. Why it took so long on that.
But the burden of making sure you're buying what it says on the pack that you're buying shouldn't be the consumer. The system should be strong enough to, you know, we shouldn't have to scan meat with our phones to make sure we're getting what we paid for.
I don't want to be reminded what shithole a Tyson chicken came from anyway.
But the system should govern that for you. The consumer protection should be there in place
you're
to
right.
make sure it is.
No, but
the
I
label.
See. So I don't know if it's I disagree necessarily, but this is my. But this was going to be my point. Where we've really lost our way in procurement, like. You know, the mother and father, right? Going to the store. So in my mom and dad's generation, they'd be able to go to a store and they'd be able to look at produce, or they'd be able to look at the meat case, and they'd be able to look at that product, and they'd be able to know what cut it was from. They'd be able to know what grade it was. They'd be able to know what utilization they would have it for at their family dinner or their event or their party or whatever. And so, you know, as that generation, you know, died off, you've got more and more and more ignorant people. They go to a case now and they say, oh, that's going to cost me $20 to feed my family. I'll buy it. They don't even know what they're buying. Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, and so this whole local movement and the slow food movement, it's bringing the consumer back to its original roots where the consumer had knowledge of what the hell was going on. Yeah. Because, you know, you've got generations now that have absolutely nothing to do with agriculture.
But again, that's not the fault of the consumer. Yeah. That's the fault of the company who sold them.
And in defense of the morons, right? In defense of the morons, our parents' generation, the options were slim, right? There was only so many staple groups of things that you could choose from. Now there's like a bazillion things they can choose from. And amongst those billion things, there's all these people trying to pull the wool over your eyes, selling you something that's not the thing. So I think really where they're trying to capture you as they're trying to say, hey, let's get these bad players out of here by like giving consumers some ability to distinguish between the fakes and the real. And like,
speaking
let's call the frauds the frauds.
Nice. I like that, Brandon.
I was also going to say that's why you shop with Saxelby Cheesemongers, Cabrito Meat, and Heritage Foods, right? You know.
Does
your,
he shop at Heritage Foods?
Is that what I do?
Yeah,
I don't know. Have you been shopping with us recently? We'd like to see you after this.
I think we're assuming that the originator of the product is corrupt, and I don't think that's the case. I feel most businesses run a business in a proper manner to make money and to have a good name. Now, yes, like anything, there's an occasional corrupt person or company or whatever. But for the most part, whether it's a big company or a small company, I know in my company, I'm providing the best product I possibly can to put out into the marketplace so my name grows.
You've given me a good transition to our next topic. So we wanted to talk about Heifer International, which is a famous nonprofit that sends livestock to impoverished families in third world countries to be raised for milk, eggs, eventually meat, also to be bred, talking about creating a good non-corrupt system. What do you think, this is a very Patrick question, what would be the best animal to give for such a purpose? If you got to be the selector of which animal went to these families.
Well, how do you figure that's a good Patrick question?
It's a little obscure. It's not what you thought I was going with.
It's obviously a goat, and that's why we asked it. And this is what a goat...
Obviously a goat. I said the same thing.
This was a setup question that everyone could see from a mile away.
This is what a goat would say. If a goat could talk, a goat would say, when you're as great as I am, it's hard to be humble. While you've been whining about corn-eating cattle and oil-dependent pesticide corporate farmers fucking up the environment, I've been healthy and happy as a clam, eating whatever's lying around. Stems, twigs, brush, leaves, weeds, grass, shrubs, even poison ivy. And I can climb anywhere, even with this on the sides of mountains, to get to it. Try getting some fat-ass cow to do that.
This is still happening today. I did a case study in the book about what the work the Farm Africa does with goats in the Tigray Valley. And they introduced 4 goats to a family 20 years ago. And once the herd had established, you can invite other people to join the program. The only stipulation is you have to give them 2 of your goats. And that 20 years ago was 4 goats. And now they've got 10,000 families with goat herds. And it has absolutely transformed not only the economy, but the environment. So they have irrigated the valley. They've now got a flower business and they've got honey business. But the thing that's most striking about it is the effect it's had on society.
The women, you were saying?
The women, female representation in government's gone up 600%. Because the women, they're overwhelmingly female-headed households because the men leave to find casual work and they never come back. And then the women get invited into the management side of the program. They get promoted through the program to the top. Then they think, what am I going to do now? I don't want to do this anymore. They leave. They have this set of skills given to them in the management of the Farm Africa and they go into local government. It's the... All the things you expect have happened, you know, that infant mortality's dropped, literacy's increased. But the thing that's really changed is the women have become part of society because now they have a commodity to sell, which means they're included in markets and stuff like that when they used to be considered difficult women if they talked. And FGM rates have decreased and domestic violence has gone down. And that's all by the introduction of goats into a system. So there is no question the answer is goats.
Definitely. And you too.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, well, it's just more evidence that just women should run everything because, you know, when we're in charge, 100%. It's just, it works, right? Yeah, Vicky knows what I'm talking about.
Can you tell us, now you live closely with 2 goats. They follow. Absolutely. Can you tell us just why the goats are
one
so
One very
amazing?
Bloated goat, she
oh,
said.
They're wonderful. They're like dogs. They're even better than dogs. They're very faithful. We go out in the woods, you name it. They're just... very wonderful animals.
Now, Simon has a bloating problem. Is that true?
Yeah. And you pat him on his belly for 10 minutes and it goes down again, but they eat about anything and they're as happy as a lark. They're great.
And, you know, you get milk, you get meat. You know, the impact is low, you know, on the land. They're able to survive.
Can we just change? Can we change
climates?
The saying to happy as a goat? Like, why is it always happy as something else? It sounds like a goat is way happier than all of these things.
Yeah, clams aren't happy.
Who even knows what the feeling of a clam is?
Yeah.
All right. Well, since we're talking about goats and Goat-tober is our theme today, I wanted to talk a little bit about food waste and livestock and sort of how Goat-tober and your work with goats, James, has worked to, for sure, reduce the waste of male dairy goats.
Yeah, well, I run a goat meat business that buys the unwanted billies from the dairy system. So I think Aaron Fairbanks described it best by saying we all understand basic biology, but we don't make the link between cheese, lactation, and pregnancy. And therefore, in a dairy system, there is 50% of the offspring born on the farm every year are unwanted because you can't milk male goats. So we go to the farms and say, please don't euthanize them, rear them up for meat, and we'll sell them into restaurants. So that's what Cabrito does. And that's sort of changing the way that the goat farming is happening, because instead of the farmers seeing, I mean, it's really important. It is a really important food waste issue, but it's also sustainability in financial terms for the industry. If we put 20% on the turnover of the farms and they make a 30% margin on the kids that they're selling, they become more financially sustainable. So the whole system is improved.
So what do? They euthanize these.
Yeah, well, when we first started, in an overwhelming majority of cases, they were euthanized.
Just shot at birth.
Yeah, shot or feedlot. In a shop, feedlot, all burned.
And how many goats are you buying? You're buying something like 40% of the billy kids in all of England.
It's closer to 30, but yeah. I mean, wow. And you know, I hope that's the hardest 30. I hope from now, like the first 6 years selling 30%, and then it gets easier as you... And it's kind of... The strategy, as much as there was a strategy, is get it into restaurant. My background is a chef, so I knew the London restaurant market really well. Mm-hmm. And the strategy is get it into high-profile chefs and let them showcase your product for you. And that's, you know, we had the dinner at Cairo last night, and it, you know, everyone leaves going, wow, I didn't know goat was that tasty. Mm-hmm. We can't, it's much easier for somebody to get to that conclusion themselves by eating it than it is for me telling them that's the case. Mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask you a question, because I know this was something that we ran up against, you know, in the States when we were first doing this project here, is that a dairy goat is not a meat goat. And so chefs were getting these, like, you know, full grown 20-pound goats, and so they're like, what the hell am I going to do with the 20-pound goat? So how have you dealt with the challenges of dairy goats maybe being a little smaller and meeting the expectation of a chef who needs the meat but has like the smaller animal?
We just grow them bigger.
You grow them bigger.
I mean, we...
What's your average weight?
About 24 kilos.
So 50 pounds.
Oh, that's big.
Yeah, so they're about the size of lambs. And that was a conversation, a dialogue that happened with the chefs, because exactly what you said, we were giving them these, you know, 12-kilo small goats, and they're like, by the time I've boned it out, I've only got 6 kilos of meat. That makes it 20 pounds a kilo. Just doesn't work. So we went back to the farmers, said, make them heavier. And the thing that we do is we castrate them, so they're never under risk of getting tainted. So there is a bigger window for the farmers to be able to sell them. It goes from sort of 6 months to 8 months. So they feel less pressure in terms of having to sell them at a certain
So you
point.
Don't save them.
Well, it's difficult.
You've just cut their dicks off.
I cut their nuts off
just
and kill
their balls.
And then I eat them.
Yeah, but they get to keep the penis.
It's
good.
Well, I think that it's difficult to convince people the best thing you can do for an animal is to eat it. But in this case, it's true. Cause
do you save the balls and sell them as meat? Because they're called fries.
Fries, yeah. We don't know.
They just fall off.
We don't.
But, you know, I'd rather be euthanized, frankly. I'm just saying.
You're not helping. You're really not helping. Well, it's better for an animal to have 6 months of life than be shot at the soonest point. In the end, Cabrito was started because I didn't feel on a real fundamental level it's right that an animal's life has no value. We shouldn't have a society where animals are born and they have no value. So, and that's what we were saying when we were euthanizing as soon as they were born. So we rear them up for meat, we sell them into London restaurants, and now it's getting more popular. We start to sell them to, you know, guys who do what you do and distribute for us and that kind of stuff.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, to me, it's a no-brainer. It's really
and it's come along at the right time as well, because food waste is something that people talk about a lot. Mm-hmm. The sort of transparency of supply chains is increasing all the time. So, and it's also, you know, it's really good for you. It's the other thing.
Well, we're actually on schedule. This is amazing.
First time ever.
I know. We're very strict about schedule here at the Main
we
Course
have
OG.
Some strong women. Some is the English. I feel like everybody's on time today.
Yes.
All right. So my next topic is actually, of course, because Anne is here and James is here. American cheese culture is at a crossroads. Recent data shows that U.S. sales of processed cheese, including Kraft Singles and Velveeta, will drop 1.6% this year, which is the fourth straight year of decline. Anne, what have you done?
Who cares? So what? Who cares? 1%?
You're talking about not calling meat meat. That stuff shouldn't be called cheese.
Oh,
that is absolutely true. Yeah. Processed cheese food. I remember
it is delicious plastic, though. Yeah, totally. Like, as a plastic edible
as a plastic product, I'm sure it has some uses. My children sadly enjoy it.
Only
thank you, Patrick, for bringing that into our household. But I heard something about that, too, and they were attributing it to millennials, you know, not wanting to eat processed cheese anymore. I'm sure it's bigger than that, but they're just better options out there.
Well, the article I read also gave a little too much credit to places like McDonald's and Wendy's that, you know, that's not cheddar on the burger. It's an Asiago, which probably is processed anyway. It was just that they were opening the eyes to people of to cheese names that maybe they couldn't identify with before instead of just a slice of cheddar.
Well, I feel like it'll probably go the way of like ambrosia salad, like all these like science foods that came of age after World War II. I feel like are kind of, you know, they had their day and they were, you know, invented because basically the military needed food that wouldn't spoil ever. Right. But, you know, at a certain point, you're like, that doesn't really taste that good. And it's not good for me
and plus
either.
1%. Who cares?
Who knows what 1.6% of Velveeta sales represents? It's probably like millions of pounds.
They're probably like 9,000 farmers.
That's actually, I think it's more significant than we think.
Oh, no, right. they're freaking out about that. I can guarantee it.
But because they're greedy bums or because it's a real thing.
No,
1%.
I mean they're losing marketplace.
Yeah,
they're losing marketplace.
Would you go crazy at the dairy industry because of soy milk and be like, how dare soy milk try to get? I mean, it's 1%. They're still like gazillion-dollar industry.
No, but you look at the long term. It's a trend. So
it's a trend.
Now it's trending.
That's what Amazon.
4 years. Yeah,
right.
4 years in a row.
That's a problem.
But that
I think it's due to markets. So. You take a look at the...
Your consumer is getting smarter,
right.
Which is what we were talking about before.
Thanks to, you know, Anne and Sex Will Be Cheesemongers, you guys are only domestic cheeses, and you know your customer, and you're a shop that people can come and learn and taste. You know, they don't give me a sample of my Velveeta slice before I buy it.
Do you think Sex Will Be is one of the reasons 1,000% for the decline?
Don't you think these are the kind of things that keep everybody accountable for the quality of product they make? These are the types of trends that start to, like... go back to the people who are producing and make them accountable for the product that they produce.
Well, they're garbage, yeah. It's
and the people that prevail are usually the people that care about the product they put forth. And you're right. Not everybody's a bad player. There's actually probably very few bad players, but there has to be some way to point out the bad players.
It's a comeuppance.
And the people that aren't really looking at it as a business that they're passionate about, that they're just bottom line greedy.
And that's
money hungry,
not good bad. It's quality, not quality. You
and
can't
I feel
make
like
the lowest quality
what you're,
thing.
What you're exposed to will dictate what you want to eat. Like, I, you know, for instance, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. I like, you know, the fancy cheese when I was growing up was the sliced white American cheese that we would get, like, hand-sliced at the deli. Like, that was the good stuff. And it wasn't until I moved to New York and, like, you know, and I went to visit a friend who was studying in Italy, actually, where I tasted cheese and I was like, what the hell? I was like, who's been pulling the wool over my eyes for like all this time? I was like, this is delicious. Like, I've never had anything like this. And so I feel like now that supermarkets are paying more attention to the quality of all their food, but cheese in particular, you know, Murray's now is in like 300 Kroger stores across the country. And so even if people are tasting like an entry level Manchego, they're going to be way more stoked about that than they are about American cheese.
How
so
much
like,
did Rob Kaufelt get from Kroger's, you think? Like $1 billion?
Oh, who knows? Yeah, he's
how
he
excited?
Did well.
How excited were you when you saw real fruit not inside of an ambrosia salad?
Yeah. Oh, that was a revelation too.
You were like, wait, you could just eat this and it doesn't have to be covered in Jello?
In Jello and like Cool Whip? This
when
is amazing.
Wait,
you
that's what you call
Jew.
Those salads?
Well,
was
I
the first Jew you ever saw?
No.
No, we, you'd seen
yeah,
those.
Yeah, yeah. I had
She'd
seen
some from afar, Patrick.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But no, my grandma June used to make something called green salad at Thanksgiving, which was literally Cool Whip and pistachio pudding mix and marshmallows and fruit from a can.
We like lived the same life. I think my grandma June made the same exact salad.
Listen, that's 1970s, baby.
Yeah, it was good. It was so good. No.
All right, before we go to break, I just want to announce two of my favorite women, Anne Saxelby and Meghan Markle, are both pregnant. We love Meghan Markle here at the Main Course OG.
I love her too.
Anne, everyone in the room, just, you know, what are some things that you can or can't eat when you're pregnant? Have you had to give up cheeses or have you stuck with them?
I've continued to eat all the cheese that I normally eat. It was actually funny. My doctor is like, she's a wonderful woman, but very, very by the book. And so when we first met, when I was pregnant with my son, she said, well, you're probably going to be sad to know that, you know, you can't have raw milk cheese when you're pregnant. And I was like, oh, I'm going to eat whatever I want, you know? And she looked very shocked. And I was like, okay, well, we'll just have like a don't ask, don't tell policy.
Well, no, I was there. You were like, I will. She's like, you shouldn't. And you're like, but I will. She's like, but you shouldn't. She wanted to go on record as really arguing against it. But as you said, that raw milk cheese from your little guys are a lot safer than the Velveetas of the world where like 30 people die a year or something.
Well, Listeria is present. It's an organism that's present in soil. And that's the organism that people are concerned about with raw milk cheese. But it's present in raw, it can be present in raw milk cheese, pasteurized cheese. It can be present in sprouts and melons and deli meats and a whole variety of things. So I eat what I feel comfortable eating, and that's often tied to where it comes from. And so if I feel like it's if it's coming from a reputable source, I'm going to feel good about it.
Because you're using that phone scanner you have, so you could trace it true. Back to the soil, yeah. that gross Listeria soil.
Exactly.
You want to say something before we go to break, James?
Yeah, just more people get sick from wrap salad. I mean, the you know, E. coli in salad gets more people sick than cheese.
Well, we need a show sometime on food is too clean.
Yeah, yes, for sure. And that's probably where lots of, you know.
They're regulating things, and we know we're in the highest regulated business in the world, and it's ridiculous. And so people's immune systems are getting depleted and depleted.
Without the microbes.
That's crazy. Yeah, I want to do an international organization in defense of microbes.
Oh, yeah.
I think we must preserve them at all costs.
The minute somebody eats something that they're not, you know, not ready for or used to, they're sick as a dog, and...
I love when people from Sweden come to New York for the first time and they're like violently ill because they've never been open to like salmon or bagels or all these like new microbes that they've never seen. Well, salmon is a stupid one to say, of course salmon, but all these germs, you know.
All right, Meghan Markle, take note. You can eat certain cheeses while you're pregnant. Just
eat all the cheese, Meghan.
I've made my diet the same since Anne got pregnant.
That's absolutely not a fact. You changed something in your diet because you also look pregnant.
Patrick's doing more pickles and ice cream, I'm sure.
All right. We're going to take a little break.
Cut
stick
that
around.
Out.
Yeah, no.
Cut it to break fast. Cut
very
that part
funny.
Out.
Funny. All right. Stick around. We'll be back with the main course OG and the weekly grill with James Wetlore.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
All right, welcome back. This is the Main Course OG, airing live from Roberta's here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. In studio, we have Anne Saxelby ducking out, and we are still here with James Wetlore of Cabrito in the UK, and also Dan and Vicky Purdy from Purdy Foods. Patrick is rustling with some delicious lard bread I brought this morning from Mazzola Bakery in Carroll Gardens.
That is, you heard it right. Bread with lard in it.
It's salami, black pepper, some cheese, all the good stuff. All right. So we're going to jump right into our section called the Weekly Grill. James, for those who might have missed the first half of the show, really quick, what is Cabrito?
Cabrito is a meat wholesale company that takes waste product dairy billies from the goat industry, rears them up, and sells them into restaurants and catering butchers all over the UK.
How many goats do you sell a year? More or less, like 10,000?
It's about, I mean, average 50 a week. Oh, so wow. whatever that is.
Wow, amazing.
All right, and the Purdy's. Can you, I know that you
How
guys...
How many goats? Is there a demand for goat? Do you sell, are
is
you
it only
for
when,
goat?
Is it only when Heritage calls?
Goat-tober?
Oh, no. We do a lot of lamb. We do a lot of processed goats for individual farms. So they'll bring us, you know, 10 or 15 or 20. And we'll process goats at certain times of year for them for farm marketing and things.
Okay.
But, so yeah, and actually, it's kind of funny. It has become more and more popular. It has become more of a thing.
And food waste is basically mothers like cows and stuff. You basically make hamburgers from them, right? I mean, you do fight the food waste thing by using old, spent cows.
In the beef industry?
Yeah, right, right.
There's no waste there at all.
Because you can make hamburger, you can't sell a ribeye and all that out of those cows.
Yeah, no, no. You can dice it and shave it and cook it and blah, 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 blah.
So the hamburger is, in a way, combats food waste.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
So can you discuss the state of the goat cheese industry in England? I mean, we're talking a lot about the goat side, but what's the beginning side?
Well, the cheese industry in the UK is kind of split into two. So you have the small sort of farmhouse model that Anne deals with, where you have small farms that make the cheese on the farm. They have 100, 150, maybe 200 goats, and they use the terroir of the area to make the flavour in the cheese. So we have a lot of that, and that's run by... The main sort of distributor of that is Neil's Yard that we mentioned earlier on. Randolph, 30 years ago, went to all these cheesemakers and said, you concentrate on making the cheese and I'll sell it, and set up Neil's Yard, which now has 3 sites in central London. And they also do wholesale to restaurants. And then there's the commercial side, which provides liquid milk for the supermarkets, but also they do butter and they do sort of the more processed types of cheese. I mean... So it's split into two. Nationally, there's about 100,000 milking nannies in the UK. 50% of those are in that sort of commercial side, the supermarket side. The other 50 are in the more farmhousey end.
Mm. And are you only really sort of working with the ones that are on this farmhouse scale? Or are you partnered with the commercial side?
We work with the commercial side because they're the ones that got the scale. You know, we started working with the smaller farmhouse ones, but as... The thing that we needed to make it work was a consistent supply, and the only place you're going to get that consistent supply is from the large scale sort of dairies that have 2,000 milking nannies, 2,500 milking nannies on the farm, and they're kidding all year round. Because what you don't want is, I mean, you guys only have it in October because that's...
No, you don't want a lull in production. Well,
you can't go to large distributors and say, I've got 10 this week, 20 next week, then nothing for a month.
Right.
You need to be able to say, I've got 20, 30, 40 every week, you know, so they can put some marketing behind it. They can put some money into trying to get the product out there. So that's what we've done. In short, what we've done is centralize the supply of goat meat, because there was goat meat being sold, but farmers would try and find their own solutions. So that local markets, maybe a local pub, maybe a local butcher. Now what we've done is just basically what Randolph did with the cheese. So you concentrate on rearing the animals on the farm and I'll buy them off you and I'll sort the sales out. Hmm.
I think also this sort of speaks to, yesterday you mentioned the existence of local and European Union government and sort of that, because of how they operate, it helps your efforts to reduce food waste through the Goat Project. But government doesn't work like that here. I'm shocked that you're saying the commercial side is where you're sourcing from. Like,
and that the mayors and governors of the towns come to your events stuff.
So we've been working with the EU because they saw that we had some success and they were running a program called Food Heroes, which was concentrating on food waste in farming. And it wasn't just the goat thing. It was also veg and fish and that kind of stuff. But there was an EU-funded program, the Food Heroes program. We were working with them, and they work across Europe. So they were going to farmers and trying to find a solution. We got involved. Because it's a part EU-funded, part sort of farmer union-funded project. And we were beneficiaries of that. Hmm. So the EU does work like that a little bit, tries to fund... Again, it comes back to the power of the French farmers and their lobbying. They can make a lot of noise, attract a lot of investment. And the things like the social responsibility of the EU is pretty good.
Well, can I ask this next question? I want to ask this to you, and then I want to ask it to you. London is an international city known for its cuisine and restaurant scene. And I really know that. Yeah. Everyone knows London. And so let's not talk about London. Tell us about the rest of the country for the restaurant scene. Is it just pubs? I mean, what's really happening? I'm talking the north, you know, and the Stonehenge town.
What's
and
happening?
South.
I think I remember somebody talking about it on one of the Heritage Radio programs recently. Like, guys have gone and cut their teeth in the big cities, then they go home.
Yeah.
So the smaller sort of provincial cities are really seeing a pickup in...
There too, huh?
Yeah, for sure.
So there's what? When you go to... Name me a town.
Like Bristol, Manchester, okay. Newcastle, Sheffield, Leeds... You know, these guys have gone, and I think that speaks to the growth in food culture throughout the UK, because when I first started, you had to go to London if you wanted to learn how to cook properly. But if I was that age now, I could choose Bristol, I could choose Manchester, I could choose Edinburgh, I could choose, you know. So it is, yeah, that's.
But they're not the backbone of these towns. The backbone of English little towns is still the pub, right? Or is that not the case?
I don't know. I mean, there's total saturation on TV.
You don't have Applebee's, do you, in every little town like we do?
No. I mean, we don't. The little towns in America are very different from little towns in the UK.
Those are still mom and pop.
Oh, so you
based,
can have a
right?
pub that's still putting out great food if yeah, the chef I mean, you, comes back.
Oh, no,
home.
I wasn't saying that.
I mean, companies like Mitchells and Butler have got 1,000 pubs in the UK, so they're not branded like Applebee's, but they are. You go into them and they look like they're handwritten chalkboards.
Is it shitty food?
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. What it is what was cool in London 18 months ago. You know, so it takes a while to. I'm sure that happens here. It takes a while to drip down into the sort of provincial menus. But that's not to say that there aren't. I mean, if you look at something like the Good Food Guide. There are absolute gems dotted in the countryside. There are places like the Parker's Arms, which is in Newton in Bowland, which is, you know, a half an hour drive from the nearest city, but it's one of the best pubs in the country.
I see.
So there are gems that stand out, but generally I think the standard of food in the UK is pretty good.
Can you contrast that with Sherburne, the region of Sherburne, New York? Sure. And what's happening restaurant wise there? Do most people eat at home? What's the story?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're taking a look, you know, you take a look at culture, right? And art, you know, replicates culture. So what you see is, yeah, we have our McDonald's and our Applebee's and, you know, there's that choice, right? And that's fine, like I was telling you last night. That has a purpose.
Yeah.
I believe it has a purpose, yeah. Right? But, yeah, in Cowtown, USA, there's some amazing places to eat. There's people coming in with little cafes and little pubs, and that the menu is extraordinary. You can go to Utica and have any type of ethnic food imaginable that is top notch.
How many of these little places do you supply?
I don't supply restaurants.
You don't supply restaurants?
No, I supply wholesale, institution, wholesalers, distributors. I don't do restaurants.
You do universities. You're at the big level. Yeah, got it. Very interesting.
I think we need to go on a little tour of the English countryside and Utica in upstate New York. All right, yep. We have two on the same day, preferably by private plane. So we have to wrap up a little bit here, but we, you know, James, are so honored to have you here celebrating Go-tober with us. We had a great event at Claro last night. We have another one at Huertas tonight. You also have a book out.
Yeah,
called
tell us
Goat.
About the book, quick.
Yeah, it's called Goat. Cooking and Eating. It's 70 recipes in the history of humans and goats, like the anthropological side of how humans and goats have interacted for 14,000 years.
You know, I hear that book is the greatest of all time.
That's what they say.
G-O-A-T.
I'm in the midst of writing a book as well. I want to introduce you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Don't Eat Grasshoppers.
Don't Eat Grasshoppers. Yeah. He was forced to eat grasshoppers at Claro yesterday unwittingly and might never forgive us. He was shocked.
It was a good laugh for all of us. You definitely cracked us up. All right, well, the Go-tober tour continues after New York.
Cities?
Where are you going?
Ibiza, Nantes.
Yeah, we've been to the Netherlands, France, and Germany, and the US. On Monday, I'm in Ireland, and then Bristol and Cornwall, and then to Ibiza. So we've done 7 countries in 25 days, I think.
Wow, all for Go-tober.
All for Go-tober, yeah.
Well, you have taken this freaking little project, this tiny project that was barely surviving. We were like that person in the lake that has just a little straw, you know. And you turned it into an international event. I mean, I cannot believe it. It's very nice for us to be able to be part of your whole thing in Europe. I mean, and now it's going to Australia.
Yeah. What's the current metaphor? If the past metaphor was a man in a pond with a straw, what is the current metaphor?
That's a good question.
He's not drowning anymore.
Emily, help me.
He's above. He's in a boat. He's doing well. We're going strong. James made out. We have a international
global logo. I think it's one of those whale
logo.
Sharks. Those whale sharks.
Anyway.
Plenty of air.
You can learn more information at gotober.us. There's also all the countries are setting up their own websites, but next year there'll be one for Go-tober as a full international group.
And we're so happy to be a small part of that. It's amazing. Yeah. Australia. I mean, wow.
Yeah, well, wherever there are goat dairies, there are billy goats with a grim prognosis.
So, no, but that it's called Goat-tober. I mean, Anne and Aaron conceived this. Emily and I now kind of carry the tiny torch here in America to try to get people to do stuff going and keep stuff going. And this has really infused a tremendous amount of energy what you're doing in every little goat farm in America, whether they sell through Heritage or not. It's like, wow, Goat-tober is in the New York Times. Goat-tober is at 80 restaurants around, you know, and in the world around thousands of restaurants. It's really cool.
And hearing Aaron Fairbanks' name said in four different accents in the last two weeks is pretty funny.
Easy E.
Yeah.
That's what we call her.
Well, we look forward to tonight. And everyone, we hope you'll eat some goat. And
come to Huertas tonight in the East Village. If there's room at the bar, tonight, try a couple of pinchos.
Tonight is October 18th, if you're listening live, 7 o'clock. And Goat-tober runs through the end of the month here in New York and around the world. So we hope you will eat some goat with us.
Go to goat-tober.us for more information. And soon, just goat-tober.
Yeah, next year.
.com.
Yeah, next year. Well, that's part of the EU funding. We'll contribute towards a standalone website where we can have individual countries sharing all of their events and more information about what they're doing locally. Because the model's slightly different in all the different countries because the systems are very different. But it still can come under the same banner. And yeah, it's a problem that's solvable. That's the thing that I've always thought about the food waste in the goat dairy industry, is that so many cultures eat goat. It's not that unfamiliar. And it's a problem that is solvable just through doing stuff like this. Mm-hmm.
And so for every pound of goat cheese someone eats a year, they should eat how many goat legs?
All of them.
All of them.
All right, this is the Main Course OG. Thanks for listening, and stick around for Tech Bites up next. Thanks, guys.
Great show.